We're checking in on childcare centers on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. These centers, they've been on the front lines providing essential care for working families. But thousands of childcare programs have closed due to rising costs and falling enrollments. That's from a survey of more than 6,000 providers in December by the National Association for the Education of Young Children. A possible bright spot here, the American Rescue Plan directs $39 billion to states to help the industry. Do you work at a childcare center? Do you have a baby or a toddler at a center? What have you faced? It's 800-642-1234. Brooke Skidmore is director of the Growing Tree Childcare Center in New Glarus. Brooke, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for the invite.
Good morning. We also have Tricia Peterson here, owner and director of Future All-Stars Academy in Juneau. Tricia, welcome to you.
Welcome. Good morning.
Well, Tricia, good morning. Let's start with you. How has your center been operating? How has it been doing in these times?
Sure. So we've been open the entire time, and we did have to lay off about, we only are a staff of 12, and we did have to lay off five of them last spring. But we're back full force and wait lists a mile long because we can't find the staff to be in our classrooms, but ultimately we're doing okay. The funding that has come down from the state has been very helpful to keep us at bay.
So. Oh, you know, a wait list a mile long, like how many families are on your wait list?
So probably just looking at the infant toddler rooms, I bet you we're not able to take another child until probably September of 2022.
Wow. Wow. Was it like this? Did you have this type of wait list before the pandemic?
No, absolutely not.
Wow. Brooke, what are you experiencing? How is your center doing?
We are hanging in there. We did have to close for a while during the initial, just because we wanted to reduce the spread among the community, and we just did not know. So we went from having, before COVID, we had about 100 children enrolled. But I want to say even before COVID hit, I had one room that was left completely empty because the lack of teachers that were available. There is a teacher shortage, and this has just exacerbated it. When we did open, we had to change a lot of our policies, a lot of our rules. We lost several teachers just due to multiple issues with not feeling safe in the childcare environment, with the lack of social distancing, things that we really can't do with young children. The pay is a huge issue for the lack of teachers. You know, trying to find a teacher knowing that they can go, you know, down the road to the gas station or Target or Walmart, anywhere, and make more. That's certainly a deterrent for getting teachers. But when we opened, we could no longer do 5 days a week, which that's been a huge inconvenience for our families.
Why is that?
So because of our policies, normally what we would do is we would stagger our teachers in and out at the beginning of the day and the end of the day.
Yeah.
Now we can't mix our teachers or our groups.
Oh.
So the teachers are working 4 10-hour straight days, like, and they don't get a break. They stay with the children for the lunch. They're with them. So we can't afford to pay overtime. So we had to take a day out. So we're only open 4 days a week right now. And that's been a huge inconvenience for our families, especially with parents trying to work themselves.
Tricia, what has it been like for staffing for you? Are you finding the same obstacles that Brooke is experiencing in trying to retain staff?
Brooke is a little bit bigger than us. We only have, our capacity is only at 48, and we're the same as Brooke. We're not able to fulfill all of our classrooms due to the lack of staffing. Our biggest competitors are Quick Trip and Max, just different factories around that can make more and give more benefits to our families and our teachers. So we do find the same issues, lack of staff, but out of the 12 staff, 7 of them are my core staff, and they have been with me since 2015, even some 2013 when we opened. So I have been very fortunate and blessed to have them. But ultimately, it's the other ones that are rotating because our expectations are high. Quality child care is hard. And the teacher social emotional well-being after COVID has been really hard to deal with kids' behaviors and different things of that they're experiencing, because ultimately kids show us through behaviors they're struggling at home. And so it's been a struggle. It's been a big struggle. We haven't lost any teachers over COVID. Everybody did come back, but very hesitant to come back, very scared to come back. We're able to stay open 5 days a week, but we, like I said, are really small. So we're the only licensed childcare facility in our area of Dodgeland School District, which is a pretty small school district, but still the nearest childcare center is probably 10, 15 minutes away. So parents don't have a big option.
We're talking with Tricia Peterson and Brooke Skidmore about the challenges facing childcare centers in the pandemic. Tricia runs a center in Juneau. Brooke operates a center in New Glarus. Taking your questions and what you have found in daycare, do you work at a center? What safety precautions has your facility been taking? Are you currently operating at reduced hours or less capacity? Share what you're experiencing. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Tricia, I understand one of your teachers did, contract COVID. What did you do at that point?
Sure. Yeah. Back in October, we did have a staff member attract COVID. We're not sure where she got it from, but we did end up having to close the classroom for, I believe it was 8 days, because of the fact that it landed on 2 weekends. So we were able to get through those 10 days. But no other staff member got it. No other child has gotten it. So it did put us out financially. I did not choose to make the parents pay the week that they were gone. So I took the hit on that. So that was quite a bit of thousands of dollars that I ate. But financially in our area, we're a very rural town. So parents live paycheck to paycheck. So they're struggling already because the cost of childcare is so high. So
Brooke, has your facility faced COVID cases?
Yes, we've had cases with teachers and with children where we had to close down the rooms. And similar to what Tricia had said, too, it, especially when it was a teacher contracted it and we didn't know where it was from. I mean, honestly, it could have been from the children, but they don't show the symptoms. And but we also did not feel comfortable charging parents for care when they could not be there, yet we still pay our teachers for that time too, because they have to live as well. So we as a business operating at less than half our capacity, it's not feasible. So without the funds that we've received, that's the only reason why we've been able to operate right now, because having a building where we have four of our rooms shut down that are just empty, yet having a wait list, the same as Tricia, I get calls constantly, especially for under two, because that's the significant childcare desert in the state. Over half of us is a childcare desert. I feel terrible. I have so many parents asking for childcare and turning them away every day.
Have these empty rooms where you have the physical space, and yet you can't staff it.
Right. It's a weird experience to have all this space and have these wait lists and be struggling financially. There's a huge demand, but I can't get the teachers. The teachers are the key component to quality. And if we can't get the teachers in there, the margins just don't work for this field of early childcare education. They're so razor thin already. So it just doesn't equate. We do need government support to actually, keep up with the demand.
We're going to look at that support in just a moment here as we discuss the challenges facing daycare centers in the pandemic. Brooke Skidmore is an early education teacher and director of a center in New Glarus. Tricia Peterson is with us, runs a childcare center in Juneau. Are you an early learning center teacher? What's your work been like in the pandemic? Have you had your hours or your wages reduced? Do you feel heard by federal and state government as aid comes to this industry? Share with us, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Child childcare centers have improvised in the pandemic, scrambling to stay open, secure enough PPE, keep enrollment up, and all the while operating, as we've heard, on razor-thin budgets. We are looking at all sides of this crisis on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Even before the pandemic, working families struggled to find safe, affordable, and convenient childcare. The group Childcare Aware of America says this is a trifold problem. How do you provide high-quality care, keep it affordable for families, and pay fair wages to employees? It's 800-642-1234. Tricia Peterson and Brooke Skidmore, they lead childcare centers in Juneau and New Glarus. Tricia, you received funding through the Paycheck Protection Program. How did that impact your costs?
It was huge for us because it was able to cover, I believe it was four pay periods for us, which is our pay periods are probably over 80% of our budget, which shouldn't be, but because of the low costs that we have and the high wages and, or I shouldn't say high wages, the high demand in regards to the bills that come in, our insurance and everything else that it costs to run a quality childcare center, it had put us, we were probably in the red all the way, we were in the red, going up to the pandemic. And then the pandemic hit and we were able to get the protection, the PPP, and also a few of the, they called them grants, but they really weren't. They were type of loans that DCF gave us, and that barely made us get above zero. So we are still fighting every day our budget. We're still trying to cut costs everywhere we can. But unfortunately, childcare is expensive and parents can't pay anymore. So we struggle every day trying to figure out, because I also can't afford overtime. So trying to figure out the best way. And this is the first time I actually had to tell parents no when they asked for extra days. And we just don't have the staff to do it. Like Brooke said, the staffing is the biggest problem we have. And it's the most, it's just really, really, to have quality, you have to have teachers that'll stay with you. And with the funding that we did get from the state, we were only able to give bonuses because it just wasn't sustainable.
Brooke, you know, could you pass these costs on to families? Could you make families pay more for care?
No, I can't. I mean, families are already paying more than they would to send their child to tuition. I'm in Greene County, and I already am charging the most for my county. But I'm also trying to turn it over to the teachers, where they also make the most in Greene County for childcare. But my families cannot afford it. I already feel bad. I'm not affordable to many children in my community because it's too much. And yet the average teacher in the state makes $10.66 an hour. That's not a living wage. And parents, like the true cost of an infant in the state would be $14,700. That's the true cost for us to care for it. Now, when we put in, that's base level. If we talk about high quality care, it costs us $27,000 a year to care for an infant. So that's why you're seeing these shortages of trying to get under two in, because it's a loss for us. We make no money when we take in infants. Those are considered feeders into a program typically, where hopefully as they age up, then we could, you know, turn over a little bit. But infants, we lose money on. And like Tricia too, I'm operating at a loss right now. Without the CARES Act funding and the PPP, we would have to have closed our doors.
Well, along those lines, Corrine wrote in to ask, what, in your opinion, do you think the best use of the federal funds from the American Rescue Plan would be to meet the financial needs of both parents and teachers and child care centers? Tricia, you first there.
Sure. I would 100% hands down use it for my staff. My staff are the ones that deserve it. They're in the trenches every day. I'm even in the classrooms every day because of the lack of teachers, but I wouldn't have to raise my prices for probably, if we were to get federal funding consistently, I would not have to raise my prices. And if I would, it wouldn't be the 10-15% a year that we do have to raise them. And my teachers would definitely see the effects of that. It would go directly to them.
Brooke, how about you? You know, the Biden administration, plans to send through the American Rescue Plan $39 billion to the child care industry. Where do you want to see it go?
I'm the same with Tricia. It needs to go to the workforce. The teachers are the main factor when we consider quality, and they're the reason why we are in this crisis. It has to go to the teachers. We know that four out of five employed people who have a degree in early childhood education are not actually working with children. So that tells us they have a passion for it, but they can't make a living for it. That's a scary thing that you want to go into this, but that's the lowest pay yielding degree you can get to is a degree in early childhood. So that doesn't equate. And the teacher's pay is what is driving inequality of education. Knowing that Wisconsin is ranked as the worst state for education inequality, we know that that starts at these early years, that children are going into kindergarten years behind. Just like on the news you had with joint finance agreeing for the mental health for these juvenile children, early child care education is the key to intervention to help these children that are facing adverse experiences like poverty, abuse, if they see violence. We have an opportunity within the early child care education to create those relationships that children need to overcome those adversities, and we're not taking advantage of that. Wisconsin does not support funding early child care and education. Historically, it's the only money we've seen has come from the federal end. So currently, right now, in Joint Finance Committee, the Department of Children and Families has asked for $106 million, and that's hanging in the balance right now. We don't know. I've been waiting to see if it's going to be cut. I hope not. We need it to survive, and our Wisconsin workforce can't survive without it. I think it is really telling that in 2018, Wisconsin lost $3 billion due to lack of child care, and that was pre-COVID. So imagine the number that we're going to see now. So if we invest in these early years, invest in those teachers, we will see that return tenfold.
We're talking with Brooke Skidmore. She heads up an early learning center in New Glarus. Tricia Peterson is here. Child care center is in Juneau. Taking your questions, your insights, are you with an early learning center? What has your work been like? Do you have a child going to a daycare center? What has that been like? 800-642-1234. You know, as Brooke, kind of lays out what is happening in the legislature, Tricia, as, an early learning center, person, do you feel like you have an organized voice compared to K-12 teachers? Do you feel like your field is unified in trying to figure out this problem when you are, approaching the legislature?
The unfortunate part in our field is that I don't think people think they have a voice right now because we're not looked at as educators, which is really sad. When children, the most important years are before the age of five. So for us right now, I feel like I've been in the field for over 20 years. Today, we have the biggest voice we've ever had before. People are coming together. They're raising their voices, but we need more voices raised. We need more people talking to their legislators, talking to their representatives, and calling them and just telling them their stories about how they're living on short margins at home and how childcare is the biggest cost beyond rent, beyond mortgage, that they're having to make decisions. Do I pay rent or do I pay my child care bills? So it is a huge thing that we do need to talk to them because they don't know unless we talk. And my biggest thing is most legislator representatives are older and they don't have children in child care. So they're beyond that. But yet they don't realize that if they don't start investing in these children now, the criminal justice system is going to get way out of control and we're going to be putting way more money into that. Because of what Brooke was saying, the investment will come back.
I want to switch topics here quickly. COVID vaccines. Brooke, how much of your staff have received them so far? What is that like?
All of our staff have received them, except for we have two teachers that are pregnant, and I don't believe they have for their own personal reasons. I definitely encourage it, but that's between them and their primary doctor.
Yeah. Tricia, how about you? Has your staff been able to get access?
So we have had a few get it, and some of the other ones are still waiting. So we have the opportunity. It's just trying to educate everybody on it and how the importance of it.
And Brooke, if you have some staff who are pregnant now, that means that you're going to need more coverage of teachers. Are you continually looking for staff?
Yes, I am. I'm glad you noticed that. I have two teachers that are both going to be due the beginning of summer and the end of summer, and that's a huge obstacle for me. And it's a huge obstacle for them. They don't have maternity leave either. This is, you know, they're talking about having to come back at 6-8 weeks when they, you know, we know that they need to bond, that attachment is needed, and yet I need them back. Like, it's a vicious cycle right now until we can get funding for the system.
Well, thank you both for joining us and explaining the situation. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us, and happy Teacher Appreciation Day.
You too.
Thank you very much.
Brooke Skidmore, director of the Growing Tree Child Care Center in New Glarus. Tricia Peterson, owner and director of Future All-Stars Academy in Juneau. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story just ahead of Mother's Day, which is Sunday.
Voice can wrap us in warm blankets. It can guide gently or yank us back from the cliff. And sometimes it can take us places we only dreamed were possible. Jan Larson and her three grown children remember a mother's voice.
Our children are grown. The magic is packed in cardboard boxes and tucked away in the loft, waiting for the next generation to reveal its secrets. The snuggler, an oversized chair that once cradled the Larsons five each night before sleep claimed our three young ones, sits empty in the corner of our living room. But once upon a time, those twilight hours held the promise of adventure, of magic, of silly laughter, as my husband and I beckoned our pajama-clad pirates to join us in the joy of reading. And when the clamor for, "Just one more, Mommy," rang out, I didn't mind a bit.
Dina, what do you remember about being read to as a child?
You did voices. And now whenever I read to friends or loved ones, I do voices. And it makes all the difference. It's even more immersive. And it's funny because just like I associate certain characters in some of my favorite stories from my childhood with you, some of the favorite characters in stories that I've shared with friends or loved ones since then are now associated with my voice and my mannerisms.
Greg, what are you thinking about? How did reading make you feel?
I just wanted to speak to what Dana said, because Dana and I read together, and I read sometimes, but most often I like when Dana reads because he's better at the voices.
Ellie, what do you remember about the Larsons five reading together at night?
We were living on our sailboat together and found a copy of the seventh Harry Potter book. And by that time, two of us were teenagers already, but we still loved having you read to us. And we made you read that book for hours on end because we were so desperate to hear more of this story and couldn't get our hands on enough copies for all of us to have separately. And I remember you begging us to let you take a break so that you could get food and some water.
Yes, I remember that very well. And then what did you do that night after I'd gone to bed? Because I went to bed with the book and hid it under my pillow.
Well, your point was to make it fair so that nobody could read ahead, but I snuck it out from under your pillow and stayed up all night reading it.
I distinctly remember being at the end of a chain of theft. Ellie would steal the book from Mom and read it, and then Gray would procure the book from Ellie and read it, and the whole time that they were reading it would be pouting at them disapprovingly, saying, "You're not supposed to be reading ahead, okay? This is for Mom to read."
What he meant was, we weren't supposed to be reading ahead of Dana.
Yeah, not without me.
Do you think ahead to maybe having your own families and what you'll do then?
Yes, bring them over so that you can read to them too.
I'll be happy to. I will be happy to. And then it will be a grandmother's voice. That will be a fun thing.
Well, you're going to have to wait a while for that. That's not coming anytime soon.
That's okay. That'll be worth the wait. Thanks so much. It is always a pleasure to get to read to you, and I hope that you have good memories of feeling warm and loved.
We always do.
They're all of the best memories.
You gave us all the good things that we have.
Oh, I love you, kids.
Love you, Mom.
We love you, Mom.
Aren't you going to say your signature line?
Oh. Thanks for making us.
And they all lived happily in harmony and peace ever after.
Writer Jan Larson is the chair of the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum. And now to herd immunity, the concept that once a majority of the population has been vaccinated or has natural immunity, life will shift back to normal. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the president's chief medical advisor on MSNBC this week, says we have to get away from this elusive concept.
We don't know what that number is for coronavirus because we've never been through this experience before. So rather than people getting hung up on this elusive threshold number, why don't we focus on the end game? And the end game is to get as many people vaccinated as you possibly can, as quickly as you can.
What's your question about herd immunity? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. Teo Voss is a professor of health metrics sciences at the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. Dr. Voss, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much.
Well, you heard Dr. Fauci there saying, we're really hung up on this herd immunity thing, and we have to look at this differently. What does the concept of herd immunity mean to you in light of COVID?
Yeah, we've already been putting out messages since the beginning of the year that reaching herd immunity, across the whole year for corona is pretty unlikely. And there are a number of factors that play a role. You have the proportion of the population that has either been infected with corona or has been vaccinated. The way it looks now in the U.S., we're going to fall rather short of the target of vaccination that would even come close to a concept of herd immunity. We then have also this spread of new variants, and some of them we call escape variants because they manage to make either your immunity from a previous infection less effective or the immunity that you can get from a vaccination. And on top of that, these new variants are a whole lot more transmissible. And the more transmissible a virus is, the higher this herd immunity proportion has to be for it to take effect. And so I agree with Dr. Fauci that we should no longer think in terms of herd immunity. We should indeed, try and get as many people vaccinated as we can, and not just in the U.S., but we should think about getting as many people globally vaccinated as we can. With the credentials of the current vaccines being greater at preventing severe disease than preventing transmission, we'll probably have to live with virus circulating for probably generations to come.
Hmm. Wow. So when you look at this concept of herd immunity, you know, what metric should we be really focused on? Is it getting as many people vaccinated? Is it number of deaths? Is it variants? What is it?
Oh, it's a combination of the proportion of the population that has immunity, either through vaccination or past infection, and the ability of the virus to transmit. And these new variants that have emerged all have in common that they have a much higher ability to transmit from one person to another.
We're talking with Dr. Teo Voss, a professor of health metrics sciences at the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, taking your questions about herd immunity at 800-642-1234. Mike is joining us from Shell Lake this morning. Hi, Mike, go ahead.
Yes. I'm just wondering why the survival rate is, what, 99.7%? Why are we all in such a freak out about it? I know some people do get very sick, but people are surviving it. So is it really necessary to have all this shutdown and all this insanity over this virus?
Dr. Voss, go ahead with the data you see.
Well, we have estimated that already by now close to 1 million people have died from COVID. That is taking into account the people that have been recognized as a death from COVID, but also those who have not been recognized as such, but are very likely to have died from COVID.
And just for parentheses here, in the United States alone.
That's in the United States alone, yeah.
Yeah.
By September, we actually expect that globally this number will get close to 10 million. So we're not talking about a trivial disease. We also see health services overwhelmed in many parts of the country, like it has been in the US when the epidemic was at its peak. On top of that, we also recognize that even people who have had milder forms of disease, about 5% of them continue to have complaints past the immediate infectious disease period, the so-called long COVID. These are people who are very out of sorts when they suffer from this. And we reckon that in milder cases, you know, on average, this will be, you know, lasting for 2 or 3 months. But in people with more severe disease, it typically will last a year or even longer. So any notion that this is a trivial disease is incorrect.
We're talking with Dr. Teo Voss, who is on the Global Burden of Disease Research Team at the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. Do you think that we'll ever get back to the way of life, how it was before the pandemic? What will it mean for you if COVID remains with us? What's confusing about why there is no standard percentage to get to herd immunity? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Dr. Voss on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at the complexities around herd immunity, why there's a debate and what constitutes it, and then what is the best metric to track our way out of this pandemic? Is it the vaccination rates, the variants, the number of hospitalizations or deaths, all of the above? Still time to discuss, 800-642-1234. Dr. Teo Voss is a professor of health metrics sciences at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation and with us for 10 more minutes. Mark is joining us from Green Bay with a question. Hi, Mark.
Hey, I just have one quick question. If 85 to 90% of the people in the world got vaccinated, would we wipe this out for good?
Well, I think 85% is a very high target. If I look at the proportions of people who currently at least say that they are reluctant or unwilling to be vaccinated. But even at 85%, I predict that there will still continue to be pockets of infection and where we'll get transmission, and even countries that have very low levels of the disease could receive a number of new cases from which another surge would come. Now, the good thing is that if a large proportion of the population is vaccinated, they're very unlikely to become very ill and, or even have these long COVID symptoms. So what we'll see is that going forward with high vaccination rates, the disease may still pop up from time to time, particularly in winter time when circumstances are more favorable to the virus. But we won't see the same corresponding overflowing of hospital wards and ICU wards.
Does that sound a little bit like having the flu, like the flu? Or not?
Well, I think people who are not vaccinated will continue to risk much more severe disease. But with the numbers of people vaccinated high enough, they will unlikely be requiring hospital treatment or ICU treatment. And so the burden on the health services is going to be coming down considerably. And so will also the number of deaths from corona. But people who decide that they don't want to be vaccinated, they'll continue to put themselves at risk.
Now, your institute does projections for the pandemic. What trajectory are you expecting the pandemic to take in the coming months?
Depends on where you are. Of course, the prospects are dire in India and other parts of South Asia, and also alarmingly in some other countries in Southeast Asia. The situation is still very, very bad in Latin America, particularly in Brazil. But in the US, things are starting to look up. We've had this, a bit difficult to explain additional surge in Michigan, but there the numbers seem to be coming down as well. So my forecast is that because of the seasonal pattern of this disease, that we'll see a decline of the numbers going into the summer. Hmm. And if we can get a large enough proportion of the population vaccinated, then I think we will still see somewhat of a surge next winter. But it's a will be far less intensive compared to what we've seen in the last year and a bit.
Dr. Voss, you brought up Brazil. You mentioned Brazil, and we heard from Mark and Kimberly, who called in, couldn't stay with us, and notes that in Brazil, the second wave of the disease was even worse, despite, Mark says, 50% of the population having had COVID in the first wave. So how could this be?
Yeah, and I think Mark is probably referring to what was happening in the Amazon region and the city of Manaus, where the first wave probably already infected more than half of the people. And nevertheless, we saw this second very large wave. So there we think that the protection from having had an initial infection with the original coronavirus was not enough to prevent getting infected again with the new variant P1, which originated in Brazil and is known to be much more transmissible and more infectious. And we've seen a similar thing happening in a trial in South Africa. The people who got the placebo vaccine who had had a history of previous corona infection were as likely to become infected as the people who got the placebo vaccine who had not had a history of previous infection. So also the variant that is now dominant in South Africa is what we call an escape variant, where it's no longer gives you protection if you've had a previous infection.
We're talking with Dr. Tao Voss, a professor of health metrics sciences at the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. Joshua is joining us from Watertown. Hi, Joshua. What would you like to say?
Well, the question, I wanted to see how your guests felt about, has there any, or do you think that it would be any consequence to if people got a fourth stimulus check to mandate or give an opt-in option, if you wanted the fourth stimulus check, if there was one, that you need to bring your vaccine card stating that you got both shots to qualify for the fourth stimulus check, if there was one, would you think that that would make a difference and at least giving us a good chance to get rid of this virus?
Joshua, looking at providing a monetary incentive from the government, what are your thoughts there, Dr. Voss?
Yeah, with many things, we know that that a carrot works better than a stick. And I would worry that, if you take away a stimulus to people who are hesitant to be vaccinated will further polarize the debate. So I'd rather look at incentives. I just saw today that New York City is advertising that foreign visitors can come and get a Johnson & Johnson vaccine as a bonus when they come. I saw people getting free baseball tickets and getting vaccinated at the baseball stadium. I think those more positive approaches, I think, are likely to be more effective than the more punishing stick kind of approaches.
I want to dig into one more thing here. Yesterday, your institute presented a new report that found COVID deaths have been grossly undercounted around the world. What is going on?
Well, our estimate is that for the whole of the U.S., there was an undercounting of probably around, just over 50%. And that's not an unusual finding. Almost all countries in the world, even those with traditionally good registration systems, have missed many cases. And that, can have been because systems were overwhelmed when the numbers were really high. It can also be that people weren't tested, even if the suspicion was high that the person died of COVID. If there wasn't a test, and particularly at the beginning of the epidemic that was the case, then they wouldn't have been recognized as such. But, there are parts of the world where we say, there's a tenfold or more number of deaths that have occurred compared to what is being officially reported.
Dr. Voss, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Tao Voss is a professor of health metrics sciences at the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. Just ahead, we look at the prospects for colonizing the final frontier, the cosmos, with a geneticist who's worked on seven NASA missions. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.